This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Any way you slice it, this country owes a whole lot of money. Today on the broadcast, the twin deficits, trade, and the budget. Bigger numbers than you are going to want to hear. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. $25 trillion of investment assets are accounted for with software from SunGard Financial Systems. More information at SunGard.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It is the 13th of November today, and maybe it's just me, but it feels like we've been talking about the dollar a lot lately, how it's not all that healthy compared to a lot of other currencies. One saving grace of that has been that a weaker dollar means American-made goods are a better deal overseas. So it was some surprise this morning when we learned the U.S. trade deficit shot up in September, a whole bunch, too. The biggest monthly jump in a decade, in fact. Imbalances between what we buy from overseas and what we sell abroad can be an economic drag, but our Washington bureau chief John Dimsdale reports there is another way of looking at that.
At least American consumers are buying again. Yes, the cheap dollar helped boost exports 3%, but imports jumped nearly 6%. Some of that was due to higher prices for imported oil, but Morgan Stanley's Ted Weissman says the rest can be attributed to economic recovery.
It's definitely an encouraging medium-term sign that imports and exports are both recovering pretty strongly. You know, it's hard to be terribly disappointed by that strong an import number because it does ultimately reflect the strength of domestic demand.
Most economists expected the dollar's decline to keep trade deficits in check, but Clyde Prestowitz with the Economic Strategy Institute says the dollar's not falling everywhere.
The big Asian countries, China foremost, but Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and many others, are pegging their currencies to the dollar. So the dollar has not weakened against them.
That could be changing, at least a bit. China has been sending signals it will let its currency, the yuan, move higher against the dollar. Former Commerce Department trade official David Rothkopf says that's not because of any skillful diplomacy by President Barack Obama.
China is increasingly becoming a consuming economy. And it needs a strong yuan so that when it imports things, it gets more value for each yuan used.
In the future, Rothkopf expects the yuan to rise a bit and the dollar to fall a bit more. Both trends should help bring trade between the two countries more into balance. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So on to debt number two now. Even though it may not seem like it, given the way Washington has been spending money the past year or so, there is actually a limit to how much the government can borrow. Right now, the U.S. credit limit, or the debt ceiling, as those in the know like to call it, is $12.1 trillion. And we're just about there. That means within the next month or so, the White House is going to ask Congress for an increase to as much as $13 trillion. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
$13 trillion. That's roughly the size of the whole U.S. economy. And right now, the government's almost entirely dependent on foreign lenders to keep the lights on.
If foreign lenders lose confidence in our ability to put our government's financial house in order, we could experience a dramatic decline in the dollar and a dramatic increase in interest rates.
David Walker is the former head of the Government Accountability Office. He warned the Senate Budget Committee earlier this week the country's walking on the razor's edge.
We will face an economic crisis much bigger than the current one if we pass a tipping point and we don't start to put our act together pretty soon.
The administration borrowed aggressively to fight the economic collapse, but what worries experts is the long-term outlook. Bob Bixby at the Concord Coalition says without changes, in 25 years, today's baby boomers will swell our yawning deficit.
Instead of a $1.4 trillion deficit, we'd have a $2.2 trillion deficit.
The solution? Trimming Social Security and Medicare and raising taxes. But politically, that's toxic. So a group of Senate moderates is trying to force the issue. They want to form a bipartisan commission to make the tough calls. Then both houses of Congress would get one shot at voting the deal up or down. No amendments, no changes. We reached Democrat Kent Conrad on his cell phone in Fargo, North Dakota.
The regular order does not work well when you face a challenge of this magnitude. We're on an unsustainable course as a nation.
Liberals in the House and Senate say a commission could force unacceptable cuts, and the administration hasn't endorsed the idea either. But the government desperately needs a credit line increase, and before that happens, Conrad wants to force it into credit counseling. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Writing in the pages of the Washington Post this morning, J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon said something interesting. Here's the actual quote. If some unforeseen circumstance should put this firm, that is J.P. Morgan, at risk of collapse, Dimon wrote, I believe we should be allowed to fail. Now, bear in mind that Mr. Dimon is speaking from a position of strength. His bank is one that actually came through the financial crisis better off than it went in. But Austin Goolsbee, one of the president's economic advisors, also weighed in on the subject of too big to fail today. He said we might be losing our big chance to change the way the financial system works, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
In a speech today, Austin Goolsbee gave a shout out to his mother. He says we have to hurry up and fix the financial system while people like her, she's a retiree in Abilene, Texas, still care about what's happening. Otherwise,
we run the danger of this thing ending up back down in the subcommittee of whatever, of the banking something in Congress.
And he went on to say, we'll just end up rewriting the same old rules we've had for years. David Weiss is the chief economist at Standard & Poor's, and he's afraid that's where we're already headed.
I think we haven't learned the right lessons. Part of that's politics. Nobody wants to give up sovereignty.
When he says sovereignty, he means who oversees what. But there's another sovereignty issue. He says if we limit how big banks can get, we could end up shortchanging them.
Unless all the other countries in the world go along with it, you're basically restricting American companies to being second-tier financial firms. If you only allow companies to grow to a certain size, if they get bigger than that, well, they end up either going overseas or going overseas that'll eat their lunch on the big deals.
But he says if we're going to let companies get that big, then we have to make sure somebody's watching them and watching them properly. James Barth is a senior fellow at the Milken Institute. He says we already have a system for that.
It's not so much that we need all sorts of new regulations, but rather we have to enforce existing regulations.
He says the system nearly fell apart because the regulators didn't do their jobs right. They should have realized that if people took out outrageous mortgages, there would be problems when home prices fell. Barth says the system isn't perfect. For one thing, it needs to be streamlined. But he and Weiss both say it's impossible to stop bubbles from forming. The important thing is to be ready to clean up the mess when they pop. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
No such thing as too big on Wall Street. Today, the major indices had a very pleasant Friday. So did most of the minor ones, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I think we've told you before how popular dollar menus have become for a lot of fast food chains. They are the classic loss leader. Get customers in the door for a buck, and then maybe they'll buy something you can actually make money on. In that light, McDonald's said this week it's considering a breakfast dollar menu. But profits are already razor thin in the food business, so Ashley Milne-Tight reports how much money chains make from those special deals. Depends a lot on how they serve them up.
Remember this McDonald's ad? A few office workers sit around bemoaning the state of the U.S. dollar. Then a colleague turns up and tucks into a burger.
That's pathetic.
Hey, big O, what do you got there, fella?
Double cheeseburger from the dollar menu.
Did I say weak? The dollar's looking strong. The
dollar's looking good.
Very good. The ad didn't last that long. That double cheeseburger wasn't looking so good to McDonald's franchisees. They said it ate into their profits. Sarah Lockyer is with Nation's Restaurant News. She says McDonald's compromised. It took the double cheeseburger off the dollar menu.
And they created a new sandwich that would be priced at a dollar that is called the McDouble. And that has two patties, but one slice of cheese. So the food costs are much lower.
Lockyer says McDonald's will consider food costs if it launches a dollar breakfast menu. The company's also made other moves to help franchisees. David Henkes is a restaurant consultant with Technomic.
They've also done a great job with menu development and creating some higher margin items that help sort of buffer the margins and raise check average a little bit.
Things like premium coffee and chicken sandwiches. It may be focused on value meals now, but McDonald's is gearing up for a better economy. It's planning to spend more than $2 billion on opening new restaurants and revamping old ones. Sarah Lockyer again.
I think they're being very forward-looking. I mean, eventually the economy will rebound, consumers will return, and they will look for more than simply dollar menu items.
But Lockyer says they will still find them. The dollar menu is too popular to drop. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace.
News of business in the economy has run the gamut the past 5 days. Proposals for new rules in the banking industry, a rally of sorts in the stock market, the president promising a job summit next month. We had it all. So we are going to go someplace completely different for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Here to help us do that are Megan McArdle from The Atlantic Magazine, also business writer Heidi Moore. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
So let's do this. Let's set aside too big to fail, at least for the moment, because I'm sure we'll get to it. And let's set aside, you know, the Dow at 10,300, because we'll probably get to that. And Megan, let me ask you this question. Are we now sort of on the precipice of another bubble, do you think?
I don't know if bubble is the right word, but I do see some irrational exuberance in various markets. I mean, in the housing market here in D.C., you have people now getting into bidding wars over houses in marginal neighborhoods and bidding up the price by more than the $8,000 tax credit because they thought it was going to expire at the end of November. You know, in gold, you have people saying we've run out and the price is spiking. The stock market, arguably a little frothy. And it's, you know, not clear why this is happening, except maybe we're just sort of having a great national sigh of relief.
Yeah, I'd be all right with a sigh of relief, though. Heidi, what do you think about this bubble? Why is it maybe not happening?
I think it is happening, and I actually think it's worse than it was last year. We've created a stimulus bubble, which consists of a housing bubble, and it consists of a bank stock bubble, and it also may consist of a hedge fund bubble. So all of these things are basically elements of the financial system that are pumped up like Hulk style in a way that they were not in September 2008.
All right, but let me rise now to the defense of those who have plowed all that money in, right? Bernanke and Geithner and the president and all these guys, stimulus and TARP and bailouts and all that. How do you manage it so that you can pull all that out without sort of either having a crash or a bubble? Megan?
Well, you know, I don't envy them their task, but at the same time, you know, they did this. They were the people who did Cash for Clunkers and the gigantic stimulus bill, which a lot of people call the porculus. They did the housing credit.
You guys are all over it today, man.
At this point, they have to own that they did this, and unfortunately, you know, they have to undo their own bad work.
Interesting you say the word own, right? Because I asked Felix Salmon and Lee Gallagher that question last week in this segment. Does President Obama now own this economy? I gather you think he kind of does.
Well, no, I don't think he owns the economy. A lot of people talk about, you know, President Obama needs to do something about whatever the crisis of the week is. And this imbues the president with a sort of magical power that he doesn't have. What he does own is the policy response. And when you have these sorts of bad policy decisions, you kind of have to take responsibility for making them go away again eventually.
Heidi, if he doesn't own it, is President Obama perhaps attached now to this economy?
I certainly think so. I mean, I think if we're honest, it's true. We're all Americans. We believe in a democratic system. And I think we have to acknowledge that what's happening right now with financial regulatory reform is not a democracy. We have czars. We have special masters. We have, you know, two houses of Congress in the same party as the White House. We basically do have incredibly centralized control in a way that historically is very, very rare.
Is there a way then, Megan, that we can have financial reform that's meaningful and
any kind of way as long as we're still trying to deal with this crisis?
I think it's tricky. And if you look at history, you know, the products of the New Deal, they didn't really happen until 33. And that's because it took a while for people to figure out what had happened and what they wanted to do about it. And I think that that's okay. But I think the bigger issue is, are we sort of losing our appetite for that? Because the problem with withdrawing credit from the system is that lots of people buy things on credit, which means that they hurt. And the people who sell those things also hurt. And of course, if you do really tight, tough bank reform, it's going to mean that there's going to be some backlash.
Heidi, quick final thoughts on the prospects for genuine reform?
I am a believer that something will come out of this, and at least part of it will be useful. For all of the disaster that the stimulus has appeared to be, it has been effective in certain ways. And although there are certain things that we'll never be able to break down, things like human nature or its close relative crony capitalism, we will be able to get some kind of format in there that will at least help us make more sense of the system than we were able to 5 years ago.
You got to believe. Business writer Heidi Moore, Megan McArdle from The Atlantic magazine. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks. Kai.
Coming up, bicycles that really move.
So it has a throttle, just like a motorcycle would, and it'll take you about 20 miles per hour for about 20 miles on a single charge.
But first, let's do the numbers. No horror stories on Wall Street today, the date notwithstanding. The Dow Industrials rose 0.7%, 73 points, closed at 10,270. The NASDAQ powered up more than 0.8%, 18 points, 2167. The S&P 500 pushed up 0.6%, 6 points, ended at 1,093. For the week gone by, the Dow climbed 2.5%, the NASDAQ rose 2.6%, the S&P 500 hiked 2.3%. Good news from earnings at Disney helped lift the market. The mouse nibbled up 4.75% today. Abercrombie and Fitch flashed up 10% after the company posted better-than-expected earnings. JCPenney rolled up 6% today. Dollar General shares started trading for the first time. The discounter closed out 8% higher, and youth clothing company Rue 21 also debuted, stitching up a 27% gain. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Senate Armed Services Committee discusses the shooting incident at Fort Hood, Texas. A monthly check-in on how much Americans are spending. The Commerce Department releases the October report on retail sales. And Do-Re-Mi made its way into our lives 50 years ago. On November 16, 1959, The Sound of Music opened on Broadway. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Now, I'm no fine art expert, but I know a comeback when I see it, and art is definitely having one. First, there were solid impressionist and modern auctions 2 weeks ago, and then this past Tuesday and Wednesday, contemporary pieces did quite nicely. Monday on the broadcast, we talked to art advisor Richard Polsky about what to expect as those sales got going at Sotheby's and Christie's. We've got him back now for the Art After Action Report. Richard, good to talk to you again.
Hey, nice to be here.
So first things first, tell us about your client. Had a painting in the Sotheby's auction. How did it do?
It was a little touch and go at first. The night of the sale at 6 o'clock, the auction was at 7, I get a sort of a desperate phone call from one of the auction house personnel from Sotheby's. The painting I was involved with was an artist named Joan Mitchell. And in this case, the reserve was $800,000. So the person from Sotheby's says, look, we're a little nervous about the sale. There are two other Joan Mitchells coming up before yours. Let's lower the reserve to $750,000. And I'm going, oh, no. And I said, do you think it's not going to sell? He goes, no. I think we're going to do fine, but let's play it safe. Let's get the audience sucked in. Let's get the bidding going. Let's pump them up. And I go, look, I got to clear this with my client. So fortunately, I was able to find her. And she comes up to me after I had explained to her what the deal was on the cell phone and whispers in my ear, no.
Ooh.
Okay, so the auction gets underway. The Mitchell I'm involved with comes up. They start the bidding at $600,000. And at $750,000, you know, the next bid is, you know, the money bid.
Right.
I'm waiting and I'm waiting. And I'm going, oh, God, you know, it's not going to sell. Sure enough, though, a paddle goes up.
What was the number at the end?
$1,000,001. What a relief.
When we had you on Monday, you told us about this woman who had worked for Warhol as a teenager, got this painting as a gift, stuck it basically in her closet. Tell us what happened with that one.
That was a beautiful moment. My God. This thing looked as fresh as the day it was painted when it was hanging there. This is the Warhol self-portrait. The estimate was $1 million to $1.5 million. With the sellers and buyers, all the premiums worked in, about $6 million.
Give me a sense of what it's like in an auction room when these paintings are going for so much more than anybody thought. I mean, there was a Warhol, the painting of the dollar bills.
Yes.
It went for $43 million. What's it like in a room when that happens?
Well, there's a buzz of electricity because you got to understand the night before at Christie's on Tuesday night, the sale was flat. The big ticket item was a Jean-Michel Basquiat painting with the unlikely title of Brother Sausage. It did not sell. So, you know, the buzzes can work the other way. When it didn't sell, the audience is like, oh, and you hear a collective, you know, groan. The next night, though, you have the antithesis, where their big-ticket item was Warhol's 200 $1 bills, estimated at $8 to $12 million. They open the bidding at $6 million, they quickly jump it to $8 million, and then someone yells out $12 million. So you knew something was going on that night. And as you might imagine, the room was just filled with this collective energy. It was like it was crackling.
Let me ask you this, though, Richard. How do you make an art market like this matter in the wider context?
You got to believe when people read the story about this $43 million Warhol, it does encourage the general economy because people are saying money is being spent. They believe there are things that will hold up, survive the test of time, and continue to be valuable assets.
Do you think the art market can sustain this bounce now?
Yeah, the art market's back. There's no doubt about it.
Richard Polsky, he's an art advisor, also an author. His most recent book is called I Sold Andy Warhol. As it turns out, way too soon, right, Richard?
Got that right.
And if you want to see the paintings we were talking about, they're on our website. It's marketplace.org. Richard, thanks a lot.
Thanks again.
Given the problems that a lot of retailers are having selling their bread-and-butter items nowadays, it might seem risky to try to sell something new, something unusual for you. But some big-name shops are doing exactly that. This week, the electronics chain Best Buy started offering fitness equipment, treadmills and heart monitors, and it's been test-marketing electric bicycles and Segways since this summer. Yes, you can still pick up a big-screen TV or a DVD player, sure, but Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports now from the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting. These new items, they're all about being ready for the recovery.
Martita Marks is just the kind of consumer Best Buy is looking for in the midst of a recession. While strolling through an outdoor market in Portland, she stopped to check out a pair of shiny new bicycles.
And I saw them, I thought, oh, I'd like to find out what they are.
The bikes were parked next to a couple of shiny young marketing types.
It's basically a modern version of a moped.
Tim Lydon was one of those marketing guys, decked out in helmet and bike shorts. He was showing off Best Buy's new line of electric bicycles. Imagine a regular bike, but with battery packs over the rear wheel.
So it has a throttle, just like a motorcycle would, and it'll take you about 20 miles per hour for about 20 miles on a single charge.
You simply just hit the throttle,
Martita Marks liked what she saw.
I was interested in for my son, who is 24 and takes a bike everywhere. And I like the idea that it's ecologically friendly.
How does the price range sound to you?
$400 is feasible.
But bikes at Best Buy? It might seem like a stretch for a retailer better known for sophisticated electronics like flat-screen TVs, game consoles, and smartphones. But Rick Rommel, Best Buy's senior VP for new business, says the company's always looking for new products to dangle in front of its gadget-loving customers. Electric bikes, with their computer chips and green energy mystique, fit the bill.
With the introduction now of a whole new form of personal transportation, we've got the right kind of internal DNA to bring something that's basically a computer and a battery on wheels to our consumer.
And Best Buy needs to do something to draw consumers in, says industry analyst Bradley Thomas at KeyBank Capital Markets.
Many of their categories are in a period of decline that is likely to continue. DVDs, pre-recorded music, potentially video games are increasingly downloaded. The consumers less and less need to go into a Best Buy.
Best Buy also has a lot of empty floor space to fill. Giant projection TVs are being replaced by sleek flat screens. Phones and computers are just plain getting smaller. Thomas says a bad economy is a good time to experiment with new products because you can figure out what consumers might want when spending picks up again.
And so the hope is that perhaps fitness equipment or the electric bikes or the musical instruments really become a growth opportunity. I mean, it's a little bit of a stretch to see it become that successful overnight, but the hope is plant some seeds and they end up yielding some nice results down the road.
Success with electric bikes, though, might be a ways down that road. While demand is soaring overseas, the market's still tiny in the U.S. The recession and lower gas prices haven't helped, says Ed Benjamin of the Light Electric Vehicle Association, a trade group.
Americans think transportation, they think cars. But Americans are very, very sensitive to dollars and cents. And as the price of oil goes up, we're going to have a rapidly developing business here.
Best Buy won't disclose sales figures. VP Rick Rommel says the company will decide whether to roll out electric scooters, bikes, motorcycles, and Segways in more markets after the holidays. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, outsourcing has hit California bovines. I don't know if people not in California have ever seen them, but the California Milk Advisory Board runs these ads all about how happy the cows here are. So happy, in fact, that they make better milk and cheese. Now we learn the spots were actually filmed in New Zealand. Cheaper there, it turns out. I will credit the Los Angeles Times with the line of the day on this one. The Milk Advisory Board, the paper says, really shot itself in the hoof on this one. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow packed on 73.7%. The NASDAQ hiked up 15.8%. The S&P 500 up 6 points, about 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, a special live show from Portland, Oregon, breaking down taboos about kids and money.
My daughter came home from school today and asked if I, or my husband, had ever had...
Spit it out, ma'am.
A 401k!
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that this weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Soul to Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Soul to Story are available now.